complementary power moves that you can do in the office or on the field or wherever your octagon or dojo of life happens to be. On the House, courtesy of Emerson Dameron, LA's number one avant-garde motivational speaker, if you see somebody you want to get some leverage on and that person asks you if you're having a nice day, say the best day of the rest of your life. They may not like you, but they will damn sure respect you. If you realize that you've said too much and you regret what has tumbled out of your mouth, say to the assembled, I trust you because you are wise enough to keep my secrets. That will shut them up good. This is Emerson Dameron, LA's number one avant-garde motivational speaker and host of Emerson Dameron's Medicated Minutes on K-Chung, kchungradio.org, medicated-minutes.com. I love you personally. Levity saves lives. Already, I'm starting to get a little jumpy. I'm in a bland waiting room area. There's some couches, other people milling around. I am free to pace. I'm free to walk around the room if that feels good. I don't have to do anything. I can sit there and twiddle my thumbs if that's what I want to do. But I can't leave. And it's starting to dawn on me that I am in a mental hospital for an indefinite stay. I don't know when I'm going to get to leave. And that's what really bothers me. Being in a confined space definitely bothers me, but it's not that confined. We're in a rural area. Space is all around. It's easy to come by. It's cheap by the square foot. So there's plenty of room for all the patients. What really bothers me is the indefinite length of time. I can tolerate almost anything if I know when it's going to be over. That's how I got through Jesus camp. I've gotten through jobs that way. Temporary jobs, obviously, but sometimes when I craft an exit strategy and I know the day and time that I'm going to be granted my freedom, I can tolerate almost any sorts of circumstances. But here, I don't know. I don't feel like I'm going to be here forever. I don't think I'm that kind of mental patient. But I don't know when I'm going to get to leave. And I know that I don't want to be here. I don't feel like I belong here. I believe that a terrible mistake may have been made. And I react the way that large mammals tend to do when cornered. I panic. I need to come up with an exit strategy. I don't know what's waiting for me outside. Obviously, I was not cured in 2 hours that I've spent here. But I need to get out of here. I'm not thinking long term. I'm thinking in the immediate term, and what I want to do in the immediate term is get out of this mental hospital. So I start making some discomfort noises, letting it be known that I'm not happy, which doesn't really set me apart. But after a while, I get the attention of my attending physician. He has designated hours every evening when he confers with the patients one-on-one. I sweat it out until I have his ear. I attempt to explain my position. I don't know if I'm okay, but I know I don't want to be here. This is not the thing that's going to help. This could make it worse. I want to get out and take another swing at civilian life. And he says, I can't let you go. I have to keep you in here for a week. And I think, okay, I'm not going to try to break out. And knowing that it's just a week will incentivize me to stay on my
best, most socially well-adjusted behavior that I'm able to, if that will help me get out of here. And he has something else that he thinks might help. He puts me on Klonopin and Trazodone, which are good drugs. Trazodone is a wonderful sleep aid. It's used as an antidepressant. It's not really supposed to be used as a sleep aid, but it's used for that off-label because it is effective. You take one of those, you'll be out. You'll have vivid, heavily symbolic dreams. Best use of symbolism you're likely to find in a dream. I noticed that when I was on that, my dreams were much closer to my real life circumstances than what I was used to. It was less madcap surrealism and more just my real experiences with one thing way off. Like, I know that I'm here all the time. This is a place that I'm in, surrounded by people that I know, that I see at least a few days a week. But I don't think that woman is normally purple. That's new. That is the Trazodone. And I'm having a dream. Klonopin is something else. That's a wonderful drug for anxiety, of which I was experiencing a lot. It shuts down any anxiety that you may be experiencing. It's a cool feeling running through your system. And I had a feeling from the first time that this drug was going to be a big part of my life. This was how I wanted to feel. I was at peace inside of the mental hospital. I sat on the couch. I folded my hands. And I just sat there. Resigned to spending a week in the hospital. No, I was happy. Because I had this opportunity to take the weight off, to relax, to decompress and reboot. Finding myself in the mental hospital is the culmination of a whirlwind romance that I had around Valentine's Day of that year. I am a college student. I like to drink alone. I like to drink a lot. And I go out to bars to do people watching while I'm doing that. Usually not people talking or people engagement or people relating, but sometimes I run into a group of people in a bar that's just so much fun that I get drawn in. this night was one of those times. I end up in a conversation with a group of friends that's hanging out at the bar. We're all drunk. We're all talkative. One of the guys in the group is one of those people who I get to know a lot about him pretty much immediately. He's very generous and forthcoming with information about himself. Effusive, almost to a fault. Within a few minutes of meeting him, I find out that he's bisexual and that he has a tapeworm. One of the other people in the group is named Marie. She has a kind of sad smirk and sparkling eyes, and we hit it off. We flirt and we bust on each other a little bit. It's a lot of fun. And we notice this is one of those bars that has board games stacked up, and you almost never see anyone playing them. Like, they're mostly just there for decoration. And we thought it would be fun to get out one of those board games and play it as a group. The game that we select is called Don't Break the Ice. You get a bunch of little white pieces of plastic, and it's a little bit like Jenga, just in a different dimension. You've got to knock them out without breaking the ice. We have a lot of fun playing this game. It's a little bit physical. As the drinks keep flowing, you start messing up. There are a lot of opportunities for conviviality. And at the end of the night, she gives me her phone number. I call her up the next week, and we make a plan to go out on Friday night. We're going to go get dinner, get drinks, and then she needs to watch a movie for one of her classes. We're going to do that in my apartment. So I clean up the apartment. I dust. I put some knickknacks and bric-a-brac out that I think might make me look interesting. I pick up Marie. We go out. We get some food. We get a couple of drinks that turn into a couple of more drinks. And then head back to my apartment after we've swung by the video store to pick up the movie that Marie needs to watch for her class, and that movie is Deliverance. So we sit on the couch and watch the movie. And we start to get cozy with each other and more physically comfortable. And one thing leads to another. And Marie quotes Deliverance at length throughout the evening. But that's fine, because we're crazy kids and we're having a good time. And we like each other a lot. Over the next couple of weeks leading up to Valentine's Day, we've answering machine messages for each other. We see each other once in a while, but obviously we're trying to keep it light. Well, she is. I don't really know what I'm trying to keep it. I know I've been lonely for a long time, and it feels good to have someone around, and laughter, and the crackle of possibility. It leads up to one Saturday where we're lying in bed and sharing stories from our pasts. And Marie shares a story with me that is pretty bleak. It's not my story to tell, but this would have been an opportunity for me to be present for another person, to show up with empathy and compassion and hear what she's saying. Instead, I talk about myself. I mention that I think about suicide a lot. I have attempted suicide in the past, and I believe that that's how I'm going to die. And that's kind of the end of the conversation. And it's also kind of the end of the flame, which I know at the time, but don't really accept charitably to both of those people. They're very young. Obviously, they're very depressed. They're coming to terms with that. They are selfish in the way that young people tend to be. And they just don't really connect. They're not ready to. And over the next week, it's clearly the phone calls are unreturned. It's over. Marie has had enough of me. And I don't take this well. I feel rejected. I'm hurt. And that's understandable. And I don't know a better way to react than to get blind, hand-wetting, pixelated, banjo drunk. Going from bar to bar, doing shots, getting absolutely wasted. At some point, I black out, and I wake up at about 4 in the morning. I have managed to make it back to my apartment, which is good. I'm in my bathtub, and the water is red. And honestly, I don't know exactly what happened here. Were I an objective third party, I would say that clearly I hurt myself. But I don't remember doing that. So it's hard to say exactly what my motivations were. Those are lost to time. I did tell my therapist about this because this seems like the kind of thing that if it happens and you have a therapist and you don't tell your therapist about it, there's really not that much point in having a therapist. I tell her, and she tells me that she thinks it would be a good idea for me to check myself into a mental hospital for inpatient treatment. I can do that on a voluntary basis. It is implied that if I don't do that on a voluntary basis, it could also be done for me on my behalf on an involuntary basis. And the choice is mine. She doesn't really need to come out and say that. It's not that hard to figure. So, I drive out to a rural area outside of town, somewhere out in Georgia, and check myself into a mental hospital, and spend a week there. And I don't know that I got a whole lot out.
Of their very existence. The contrast between our rich inner lives and our awkward public presentation, between our ideals and the ways we actually think and behave, can be overwhelming at times for the best of us. We see everyone else's highlight reel, but we get our own unedited raw feed. For anyone with a pinch of self-awareness, assembling the right director's cut is the struggle of a lifetime, filled with agony, regret, and solitary insights we can never really share.
On Ward 3. Ward 3 is for the patients in the hospital who may not be here for that long. The ones who benefit from talk therapy and group therapy and such. The ones who engage with other patients and the doctors and the nurses. Ward 3 is kept separate from Ward 2. Ward 2 is for the harder cases, basically permanent residents. Occasionally there's a dust-up on Ward 2, and we can hear it on Ward 3. Lights out for Ward 3 comes fairly early, and then we get to fall asleep while the real action is just getting started on Ward 2. I guess being privy to what's going on Ward 2 to this extent has a there but for the grace of God go I type of quality to it. The world keeps presenting me with these opportunities to have compassion for other people, get some perspective, realize that I'm not the center of the world, and I keep missing out on them. Charitably, I can say that depression cuts you off from a lot of things, empathy being one. Also, aside from being depressed, I was maybe just a little bit selfish. Group therapy is my opportunity to get to know my neighbors. And yet again, I'm given some clear examples of real human suffering that exists in the world outside of the confines of my own little self. People are in not so great family situations. My roommate is very stoic. He's quiet. He keeps his own counsel, which I appreciate. He reminds me to do the same, which seems like the best policy. Generally, the quieter I am, I sense the better things are going to go for me. His wife and kid come in to visit him during the family visitation hours. Fortunately, I don't get any visits from family. And he and his wife end up in screaming fights in front of the kids. And my heart does go out to him a little bit. I do wonder what he has to go home to when he gets out of here. I don't know why he's here. It doesn't really come up. Generally, it's not a good thing to bring up. Talking about the weather or sports or the quality of the food and how it is lacking are better ways to make conversation if you're in a mental hospital. There's another guy who's the friendliest person right away. He wants to meet everyone. He's very solicitous. He's been here for a while, and he's friendly with some of the other patients who've been here for a while, particularly the older patients who may be neglected by the people outside that could be taking care of them. This guy is always there for conversation. He's charming. He's funny. In group therapy, it becomes apparent that there's something very dark in his family, and it's him. He's in here because of something he's done that's not really discussed, but when it comes up, when it's alluded to, as it is by some of the folks who have been in here for a minute, he changes dramatically. He's not friendly. He is not charming. He goes into a fugue and gets lost there a little bit. I don't really enjoy group therapy. I don't feel that I'm getting a lot out of it. I do really enjoy art therapy and fitness. The time that I spend in the gym, lifting weights, exercising, jumping rope, is wonderful. It is by far the best thing that I do in the hospital for my own mental health. And I think there's something there that I still need to remind myself, that if I mix it up physically, if I get moving, if I get my blood circulating, it will change the way that I feel. There is no body-mind separation. Your thoughts are part and parcel with how you're doing physically. And if you start moving around, if you start doing things, if you start taking care of yourself physically, using the energy that you have, it will help, in my experience. And I still have to remind myself of this. I think the beast of alcoholism, more than the fact that I was poisoning myself, really is that I'm cramping my own style so badly and keeping myself in bed until after lunch, sometimes all day. That sloth that it enables, to me, is equally bad. And what I realized when I finally quit is that what I needed to do was get up and bounce around and pace and move and do things. And that was a tremendous help.
Yeah.
after a week, it's time for me to go home. Back to the college town where I live. I say my goodbyes. I check out. I am not fixed. I'm not cured. I don't know that I have learned much of anything from this experience. I know that I like having freedom. I consider this a speed bump. I'm ready to get out. I'm ready to go home. I'm ready to leave the hospital. And I'm ready to do the thing that I've been thinking about doing and planning on doing the entire time that I've been in the hospital, which is to go back to town and hit the bars with a vengeance. I don't know if I'm ready to do that. I don't think about whether or not it's a good idea, but it's what I've been thinking about, and I want to get back in my element. So I drive home and go out immediately. I have not had a drink in a week, so I'm ready to get started. It feels good right away. In fact, it feels good in an entirely new way, because this time I'm combining alcohol with Klonopin, which is a whole new experience. And that foreshadows some pretty gnarly experiences that are on the way. Looking back on it now, I do want to thank the staff of that hospital. I want to thank the doctor who pushed me to go in there. It was a week off. It was a different experience. I left not feeling like I belonged there. And maybe way down the road, I appreciated some of the things that I experienced and got something of value out of that. I like to think so. I like to think that there's something in all of our experiences that we take with us. I know I didn't learn my lesson. I know I didn't get fixed. I didn't fix the depression. I didn't fix the selfishness. But I was out. And away I go.
We'll be right back.
You've been listening to Emerson Dameron's Medicated Minutes, written, produced, performed, conceived of by Emerson Dameron. That's me. We heard music from Jesse Spillane, Ami Dong, Earth and Sea, and Alex Bundy's Planetarium Music. Emerson Dameron's Medicated Minutes is made possible by K-Chung at kchungradio.org. Thanks for listening. We'll make this a regular thing.